Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. Today on Sound Medicine, we'll be speaking with the nation's top infection fighter.
The inappropriate use of antibiotics is a major issue.
Plus, what marijuana does to the developing brain.
The most problematic time is probably adolescence, when it can interfere with the things that you should be doing to grow and develop.
Is it possible to recover from schizophrenia? Our guest believes it is.
Recovery doesn't mean that the person has to no longer have the burden of their illness, but that they're learning to meet their own personal goals despite having an illness. The voices aren't really alien experiences. They're actually the person's own thoughts.
And how to tell if you have an addiction?
If it's possible, solicit the opinions of your loved ones. Maybe my marijuana use is a little more problematic than I thought. I've always thought that no one ever noticed.
We'll tackle all that and more. Next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. We begin this week with a solution that is becoming a problem. In short, antibiotics used to kill bacteria, but are now losing their punch.
What we're seeing as a more and more growing problem is that there are microbes now that more commonly, particularly in a hospital setting, are resistant to many, and in some cases, essentially all of the antibiotics that are available. And that becomes a scary proposition.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Recently, he wrote an essay in the Journal of the American Medical Association with suggestions on new ways to approach the growing problem of bacteria, which are resistant to antibiotics. He spoke with Sound Medicine's Jill Dittmeyer.
Well, Dr. Anthony Fauci, welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
For years, the media has been covering the threat of this antibiotic resistance, but headlines lately have sounded a little bit dire. How serious would you call the threat of antibiotic resistance to global health?
I think it's really quite a substantial threat. It's certainly getting worse. We have really no corporate memory of what it was like prior to the era of antibiotics, which have been transforming in their life-saving capabilities, because we've been used to having infections, no matter how serious they are, that somehow or other you can treat them, you can find the right antibiotic. But things that you could have easily treated years ago, now we're having difficulty because of the emergence of antibiotic resistance.
And which of those strains are you most concerned with now?
Well, there are several. The ones that are really of concern are what we call the gram-negative microbes, the Klebsiellas that we've heard about outbreaks, and we've even have an outbreak here in our own hospital at the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland, but it's not unique to us. It really happens all throughout. There's a microbe called C. difficile, in which there have been outbreaks, particularly in nursing and extended care homes, that have become resistant. There's the ever-present methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, that everyone's familiar with because it's been around a while. It started off as a hospital-acquired infection, and now the thing that gets a bit concerning is that MRSA, or the resistant form of Staph aureus, is seen in the community, and people are getting infected apart from being in the hospital. And then there's the issue of certain sexually transmitted diseases, such as gonorrhea, which is now becoming resistant to many of the common antibiotics that very easily treated them. So there's a whole group of microbes, particularly the ones that I've just mentioned, that are of particular concern.
And how did that happen?
Well, it happens over a period of time from a number of factors. It isn't a unidimensional thing. Probably the inappropriate use of antibiotics is a major issue. There have been recent studies that show that, you know, as much as 3/4 of the adults who might come into a clinic with bronchitis who have a viral infection are getting treated with antibiotics inappropriately, because you don't treat viral infections with antibiotic. And whenever you treat an infection with an antibiotic, particularly one that you don't need, you do a process which is called selection of strains that ultimately are resistant to the antibiotic. So if you kill off all the good sensitive bacteria, what you're left with in the community in general, and specifically in a given individual, is a microbe that would be resistant to common antibiotics. So inappropriate use of antibiotics is one. The other reason is poor identification of resistant strains, not even being aware. And that comes under the category of better diagnostics, to be able to determine that you're dealing with a microbe that's resistant to antibiotics. The other is surveillance, and that is very closely linked to the diagnosis that I just said, particularly in hospitals, because sometimes you have hospital outbreaks that are under the radar screen and people don't notice it. And then there's infection control measures, which we do in hospitals well, but in some hospitals not so well. So if someone would come in either with an already established resistant microbe, or it happens in the hospital, that if you don't have the proper infection control capabilities, that could spread either to the healthcare providers, who might spread it to other people in the hospital, or even to bring it home to their own family. So it's a whole cascade of events. And then there's the issue of the inappropriate use of antibiotics in agriculture, in animals, not to treat a disease in the animals, such as livestock, but for growth purposes, because it's known that if you treat them with antibiotics, that you can have a greater acceleration of growth of the animal. And that's not an appropriate way to use antibiotics. So there are the 5 or 6 things that I just mentioned, all come together in a way that actually promote the increase and the surge in antibiotic resistance that we're seeing today in the 21st century.
So what is your advice to consumers then, when they come down with an illness, or that we see all these products that say, you know, use this and have the antibacterial properties? What should we be doing?
Well, I think one of the things that can be done that's quite helpful is, don't put pressure that's inappropriate on your physician to give you an antibiotic unless there really is an indication. I mean, it is unfortunate, but the truth that a typical scenario is that a child has a sore throat, there's no bacteria identified, but the child is in some discomfort, and the mother says, we've got to give the baby an antibiotic, or the adolescent an antibiotic, when you don't really need an antibiotic. I mean, one of the most common of infections that are inappropriately treated with an antibiotic that don't need it is that when someone gets an upper respiratory tract infection and then develops a slight either a bronchitis or a sinusitis. Now, that could be a bacteria, and if it is and it's documented, then it's appropriate to treat someone with an antibiotic. But a significant percentage of those upper respiratory tract infections are not bacterial. They're viral, and they should not be treated. So I think parents being somewhat less aggressive in trying to push the use of antibiotics, when in fact the physician might be a bit reluctant to do that.
We are speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci. He is with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Do you foresee then the development of new drugs in the future?
Oh, yes. One of the problems that has occurred is that there really has been a lagging in what we call the pipeline of new antibiotics, for a number of reasons, including the lack of incentive on the part of many of the drug companies with the capability of making antibiotics. They just really put their resources in other areas and not the antibiotic area. Because if you look at for example, 16 antibiotics were approved by our Food and Drug Administration from 1983 through 1987, whereas only 2 new antibiotics were approved between 2008 and 2012. Now, that's getting better now over the last 18 months to a couple of years, But we've got to reinvigorate the pipeline of new antibiotics being produced. So we really need to do better in that regard.
What about vaccines? Do you foresee a vaccination that might help?
Well, the answer to that is yes, because you're not going to get antibiotic resistance to microbes that you don't get infected with. So one of the ways to circumvent or avoid the emergence of antibiotic resistance would be to prevent the infection in the first place. Now, there are a number of ways to do that. One of the most efficient and cost-effective way to prevent infection is by vaccination. So let me give you an example. I had mentioned just a bit ago that methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or what we commonly refer to as MRSA, is an important problem, as well as some of the gram negatives, such as the Klebsiella or C. difficile or other types of antibiotics. If someone is in a clinical situation, such as getting ready to go into the hospital for an operation in which one of the complications is an infection of a particular surgical site or of a particular apparatus that gets put into a person, one of the ways to avoid having to treat somebody with the possibility of antibiotic resistance is to develop a vaccine. And before you put the person in the risk situation, and the risk situation being entering a hospital, getting surgery, getting a transplant, or what have you, that if we had the appropriate vaccines, we could prevent those infections before they occur, and hence not have to worry about antibiotic resistance with those infections.
Your organization also talks about kind of changing our own natural bacterial environment in our bodies as a way that might help as well.
Well, it could help and it could hurt. For example, we have in our bodies an enormous, enormous number of bacteria that are safe. They're not doing harm. They're living in some respects, in a helpful, productive way. They colonize the gut. They colonize the nose, the oral cavity, the skin, the genital organs, the vagina in a woman. And those are the kinds of things that are naturally occurring. When you inappropriately treat someone with antibiotics, particularly for a prolonged period of time, you perturb that microbiome, as we call them, which is the broad colonies of microbes that safely live within us. So we have to be careful that there's a couple of ways to cause harm by inappropriately using antibiotics. One, by selecting for a specifically resistant bacteria. And the other is by unnecessary perturbation of the natural bacterial flora in the body.
So how do we balance the fear of this and be proactive but not overactive, I guess?
Well, one of the things is you don't want to interject fear into this. We don't want to be afraid. We want to be alert and we want to be proactive in doing things about it. We want to avoid the kinds of things that we know are leading to antibiotic resistance. And I mentioned a few of those, particularly making sure that we don't inappropriately use antibiotics. The research field, like my colleagues and I, can do things by developing better diagnostics for surveillance, better hospital control when there are outbreaks, and ourselves make sure that we judiciously use antibiotics. So there are things the public can do, and there are things that the health and science sector can do.
Well, Dr. Fauci, thank you for joining us today.
You're quite welcome. Good to be with you.
Dr. Anthony Fauci directs the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is one of the National Institutes of Health. We'll post more information about antibiotic resistance on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and your Sound Medicine stat is 10. When you look at marijuana's popularity in the United States, you'd think it were legal. In 2012, nearly one-third of adults ages 18 to 25 had used it in the past year. But marijuana is only sort of, not quite fully legal in some places. A bunch of states allow it for medical use. It's legal under state law for adults 21 and older in Colorado and Washington. But even in all these places, using it is still a federal offense. If it ever goes all the way, no asterisk legal, would more adults use it? In a recent study of high school seniors, 10% who had never smoked marijuana said they would start if it were legal. This included teens who were religious, or didn't smoke cigarettes, or whose friends were of the just say no variety. If Johnny Law becomes completely cool with marijuana, many people, especially young adults, will indeed be using it. But then again, many indeed already are. That was the number 10, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up, marijuana's effect on the brain and body.
The most problematic time is probably adolescence, when it can interfere with the things that you should be doing to grow and develop.
And why schizophrenia isn't always a dead-end diagnosis.
There are many more people with schizophrenia who are actually working or going to school than there are on the street living very difficult lives.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Let's check in with Jill Dittmeyer for this week's health news headlines.
Thank you, Barb. This week, a federal appeals court ruling threatened to make health insurance under the Affordable Care Act less affordable for many. Some people could lose the subsidies that help pay for their premiums. But that's unlikely, says Dr. Aaron Carroll, a regular Sound Medicine contributor.
So basically what happened was that the Affordable Care Act has within it a clause which unfortunately is poorly worded. And it basically says that subsidies can be given only to people who get insurance through state exchanges. And because a lot of the exchanges are actually now federal exchanges, maybe 36 to 38, depending upon how you define them, these exchanges would not be qualified for a subsidy. So anyone who is in a state where their exchange is being run by the federal government, they could lose the subsidies which help them buy insurance.
Dr. Carroll predicts that this issue will wind through the court system, perhaps up to the Supreme Court.
Even if this ruling was upheld, it is not difficult for states to fix this. Theoretically, a state, even with a federal exchange, could say, we're going to set up a state-based exchange whose only job is to outsource its workings to the federal exchange. And that would then therefore qualify still to get people subsidies. So it would take, you know, Congress not wanting to fix this and a local state government not wanting to fix this for the problem to remain.
Though some headlines called this a lethal blow for Obamacare, any impact from this ruling may come years from now, he says.
I think if you're saying, how will this affect people at a local level? Very little right now. How could this affect people in the future if we saw a worst-case scenario? Well, there's a lot of people who could stand to lose tax credits and insurance would become significantly more expensive for them. But there's a number of things that would have to fall, a number of dominoes that would have to fall in succession, and I'm sure we'll have many conversations about what would likely happen between now and that date.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
This summer, New York has become the 23rd state to legalize medical marijuana. The new law won't take effect for 18 months, and when it does, the measure puts very tight limits on how the marijuana can be administered, by pill or vapor, but not smoked. And there are just 10 illnesses that qualify for a prescription for medical marijuana. Serious conditions, such as cancer, HIV, Parkinson's, and ALS. Dr. J. Michael Bostwick is a psychiatrist at the Mayo Clinic. When we spoke with him last fall, he had just published a major paper on the health effects of marijuana.
The basic conclusion I draw in the article is that we need to be studying the endocannabinoid system and cannabinoids. We have a lot of drugs that are based on plants, and potentially pharmaceuticals could be developed if we understood the endocannabinoid system better. That's where the pharmaceutical development has been extremely limited because it's so hard to get permission to study them.
So if we're talking about smoking marijuana here, what are the dangers?
Well, the dangers vary quite a lot depending on the age of the person who's using it and for what reason they're using it. Obviously, if you use a burned substance for many, many years, you run a risk of lung pathology of various sorts. If you use it potentially while driving, you might have poorer reflexes. In kids, it may unmask psychotic illness if there's a tendency towards that. It may cause poor school function or poor work function if a person is using the drug rather than attending to the things that are age appropriate for them. Basically, the literature says that in people older than 25 who start using this medication, there's almost no one who becomes addicted. And the most problematic time is probably adolescence, when it can interfere with the things that you should be doing to grow and develop.
Mm-hmm. What about you touched on it, the risk of schizophrenia, to have that first break, if you will?
Well, the risk here is to have the first break come sooner, but it doesn't cause schizophrenia. The association is with a disease coming out earlier and more intensely, and then if the person continues to use it, the person having a rockier course with the disease.
Okay. When we're talking about marijuana use in adolescence, reminds me of kind of the arguments against alcohol use. Are there some parallels there that, you know, give alcohol in an adolescent brain functions differently and will leave children vulnerable for long-time problems?
Well, I think the principle that might link them both is that the brain is still developing rapidly. It's being remodeled in adolescence, and if you introduce substances that are potentially going to interfere with that remodeling process, that development process, then you can get into terrible trouble. Alcohol has a higher rate of addiction and has many other complications that are life-threatening that in high doses that marijuana does not have. You know, I think that basically any substance used by an adolescent potentially affects that developing brain, and that is different than what happens with older adults.
There's a lot of debate over whether or not marijuana is addictive. What's your take on that?
Well, I think there's no question that it's addictive. The studies have shown that about 10% of people who use it will become addicted to it, which is actually less than alcohol, cocaine, nicotine, and other substances that are around, some of them legal. So the notion that it simply doesn't cause addiction is not true. It's been shown as well that probably if you start using it after 25, often in a medical situation, you won't become addicted. That being said, some of the people who are most likely to use marijuana medically are people who have some experience with it recreationally when they were younger, and they're not bothered by the effects on the mind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because I think in your article you had mentioned that for some people, smoking marijuana is a very pleasurable experience. For others, it produces anxiety and kind of...
That's right, for sure. And also, the other thing is that these days, you have no idea what is actually in the marijuana that you are smoking. Even though there has not been research of a legitimate sort, the breeders who grow the plant have been growing different strains that have different proportions of the active ingredients in them that can have different effects on different people. It also may be that if you smoke in certain situations as opposed to others, you're more likely to have a negative reaction. But understanding marijuana as one plant is simply misleading, because at this point there are so many different varieties with so many different strengths of active ingredients.
Mm-hmm. I think in addition to the debate over whether marijuana is addictive is also that debate that marijuana use leads to the use of harder drugs.
Actually, one of the things that I thought was quite funny is that marijuana, you run the risk if you use marijuana of becoming a cigarette smoker.
You're going backwards.
Well, that's what I read.
In some ways, yeah.
That's what I read. And I mean, you know, everybody knows the story of somebody who used marijuana and then started using cocaine and alcohol and whatever else. But I don't think it's a cause and effect. I think in many cases you're around people who are using substances. Adolescents in particular like to experiment with lots of substances, so they get exposed to these things. But the notion that somehow marijuana makes you try other drugs, I think is rather simplistic.
Okay. So since this is a medical show, marijuana as medicine, where does that fit in your mind? I mean, what conclusion did you come to about using marijuana as medicine?
Well, the first thought that I have is we're in an utterly crazy situation when nearly half the states have legalized it and the federal government has not. It seems to me that that immediately sets up marijuana as medicine as being very problematic when your doctor can be arrested for federal crimes when in a state where it's legal. Now, I think, as I wrote in the New England Journal, in a situation in which the marijuana is given in a longstanding, ongoing relationship with a physician, then it can be part and parcel of things to try. Doctors know about medications and pills and whatever, but they still are working with one patient at a time and trying things that may or may not be helpful. The key that I keep emphasizing as I write about this is that it needs to be done in relationship with a physician who is following your care. I also make the point over and over again that if your use of this substance starts interfering with your function, the things that you are supposed to be doing, then you've got trouble. For some people, it permits them to do things they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. Again, I don't think we fully understand this, and what I always conclude is that we can't possibly fully understand it if we can't even really study it.
I'm going to ask you for kind of your best case for not legalizing marijuana, and then the other hand, your best case for legalizing marijuana. So, to your mind, what's the strongest case to be made for not legalizing marijuana?
It's almost very hard to answer that question because it seems that the horse or the whole herd of horses is way out of the barn. And, you know, arguments that are made about prohibition come to mind. That in a sense, we could make it illegal, but so what? It's used by millions of people. It's available. People grow it in their gardens. As a pragmatic man, my thought is the question is interesting but fairly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of legalizing it, I think that it would permit it to be studied and perhaps for pharmaceuticals to be developed from it. Again, I'm impressed by the science that says that there's a whole system in the body that's run by these chemical, related chemicals to what's found in the plant, and that we could learn a lot by that. The trouble with this or opioids at this point, prescription opioids, or alcohol, as they all come with risk, and we're always going to have to be balancing the benefits against the risk. I know I'm sort of dodging the question, but I don't think that either legalizing it or making it illegal will solve the problem. The reality is that there's marijuana being used recreationally, there's marijuana being used medically. Some states have legal marijuana, some states don't. The federal government wants to believe that we can just sort of legislate this in such a way that it won't be a problem, but the problem is here. The title of the article really speaks to that blurred boundaries. I was just impressed. You know, as you've already mentioned, it's a very long article with many sections, but each time you make one argument, there's a counter-argument, no matter what you're talking about, whether it's recreational, whether it's medical, whether it's historical. I thought the issue might be fairly cut and dried, and if I just did enough research, I could eventually get the answer. But what I came away with was that there are all these contradictions and all these balancing, competing needs that the drug presents. Anyone who's interested in this topic should appreciate that it is going to be a complex topic and there's not going to be a simplistic or easy answer on the medical side, on the recreational side. That we have to make judgments based on the information that we have and not just assume that we can come up with some one-size-fits-all solution to the problem of either recreational or medical marijuana.
Dr. Michael Bostwick is a professor of psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic. We'll post a link to the paper he wrote on the health effects of marijuana. You can find it by going to our website at soundmedicine.org. And while you're there, you can also listen to his story about his son's struggle with drugs that spurred his research. All right, shifting gears now, or at least changing positions. Want to make your next meeting more productive? Take away the chairs. Jill Dittmeyer explains in this week's Sound Medicine Checkup.
Professor Andrew Knight and his colleagues at the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis were talking about new office furniture 1 minute and a more interesting management question the next.
There was the option of a standing desk that came out of that, or an adjustable height desk that faculty members could use. We just started kind of speculating about what the impact of standing meetings for groups might be on how they interact with one another, how they come up with creative ideas. So we kind of went through the process of thinking about what might happen if we got rid of the traditional conference table setup and chairs, and instead presented people with an environment in which it was, you know, it was chair-free. It was non-sedentary.
They gathered two groups of college students and told them to discuss a project.
And some of those groups were randomly put into a room that had a traditional conference table and chair set up, and other groups were randomly put into this non-sedentary space that was chair-free.
And outfitted them in wearable technology.
So we used bracelets that individuals wore that tracked activation of their sympathetic nervous system. So it measured kind of physiologically how activated their bodies were.
And discovered that the standing meeting group was much more collaborative.
So the people in those groups would, you know, hear something that someone else said, and they would build upon that idea, and then someone else in the group would kind of take that kernel of an idea and expand upon it and build upon it further.
And less territorial.
So if you think about kind of a brainstorming meeting, people sometimes have their own ideas that they throw out on the table. And in the standing meeting, people were comfortable and willing for others to build upon and take their ideas and run with them. Whereas in a sitting meeting, people were more protective over their individual contributions and were more individually focused as opposed to collaboratively focused.
Knight says the study shows movement in a meeting is good for the body and the mind.
I think what we've seen a lot in the media has been really the health benefits, and those are very real, the health benefits of adopting a more non-sedentary lifestyle. But beyond those, there also are some benefits when people are working together in groups that this standing format can lead to collaborative and more interdependent meetings.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Stand in the place where you live. Now things know. Think about direction, wonder why you have it now. Stand in the place where you were.
Do you want to listen to Sound Medicine anytime? Sign up for our free weekly podcast. Click the box at our website, soundmedicine.org. You can also find us at iTunes, at Stitcher Radio, and at Swell AM.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. The term schizophrenia strikes real fear in a lot of people, and for good reason. The symptoms can include hearing voices or lack of affect or energy, and this form of mental illness has been blamed as the root cause for a number of crimes over the past years, including the horrifying mass murders in Connecticut and Colorado. But our next guest is a psychiatrist and expert on schizophrenia who believes some people with the diagnosis can regain their function and productivity. Dr. Stephen Marder is at the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience at UCLA. And we began by addressing one of the most common perceptions, that there's little hope of recovery from schizophrenia.
You know, the impression that people get about people with schizophrenia too often comes from people who are doing very badly. People that they see who are homeless in the streets, pictures in the media from people who have done awful things. Actually, there are many more people with schizophrenia who are actually working or going to school than there are on the street living very difficult lives. It's more common for people with schizophrenia to have a burden from their illness, but to be, you know, trying to make the most of their lives.
In the past few years, a few people who are managing their schizophrenia have done very well. They've gotten media attention. I'm thinking about the TED Talk I watched, a law professor who won a MacArthur Genius Grant. How often do people with schizophrenia really manage to thrive socially and professionally?
Well, it's hard to know how many people thrive. The person you're referring to is Ellen Sachs, who's lived an extraordinary life despite having to deal on an almost constant basis with symptoms of schizophrenia. So it's hard to know how many people there are. We did a study in Los Angeles along with Dr. Sachs where we identified people who were relatively high functioning. physicians, attorneys, psychologists, other people, and we actually brought them in and interviewed them and tried to find out how they manage their lives despite having these illnesses. Mm-hmm. So we really don't know how many there are, but they're definitely out there.
So put us in the shoes of someone with schizophrenia who's in the grips of the symptoms. I mean, what can daily life be like for them?
Well, many of them talked about having symptoms like hallucinations, commonly hearing voices, finding it hard to be in overstimulating environments. They found sometimes they would develop suspicious ideas about people around them. What we found is that those people had learned during the course of their lives how to monitor themselves when they began having these distortions and how to kind of manage them so that they could continue in their lives. For example, some of them found that in their working life that sometimes they would need a quiet place when things became overly stimulating. Dr. Sachs, in a wonderful book that she wrote called The Center Cannot Hold, talked about how she would, you know, deal on a frequent basis with some of these symptoms and still manage to continue on in her work. So I think that people develop their own solutions to these problems, particularly those people who are successful.
Yeah, and there was another TED Talk with a younger woman, a doctoral student, who was talking about how what she was hearing the voices say really gave her an indication of how she was feeling. Instead of being afraid, you know, she kind of took the cues from this voice.
Right, right. And I think what this person learned is that when an individual hallucinates, which is a surprisingly common experience to people, that what they're actually doing is they're interpreting their own thoughts as a sound. So, I mean, the voices don't come from anywhere except the person's own mind. And I think that these people have learned to accept that, and they actually gather information. There was a humorous line, and I think it may be in the same TED Talk you're referring to, where she was taking some kind of an examination, a written examination, and the voices were actually telling her some of the answers, and she wondered whether that was cheating, that her own voices were telling her the answers. So in other words, the voices aren't really alien experiences. They may seem alien, but they're actually the person's own thoughts, and, you know, perhaps they can be helpful in people learning what they're not consciously aware of.
Well, you believe that recovery from this disease is possible, but I was wondering how you define recovery.
You know, I think recovery is the individual's ability to live the kind of life that they want to, despite having the burden of an illness. And one could look at a parallel in other illnesses. For example, people with rheumatoid arthritis, you know, they'll still have the burden of their joints being limited, but they develop methods to kind of work around it and to meet their own personal goals. So I think it's recovery to me, and I think to many people in the recovery movement, doesn't mean that the person has to no longer have the burden of their illness, but that they're learning to meet their own personal goals despite having an illness.
You mentioned recovery movement. How well is this idea of recovery from schizophrenia accepted in the mental health field?
I think it's becoming increasingly accepted. I mean, a number of years ago, it must be more than 10 years ago, under President Bush, the President's New Freedom Commission actually accepted many of the principles of recovery. And I think if you go to many of the more advanced places that treat people with serious mental illnesses, that they are aware of some of the principles of recovery, about the person setting their own goals, about, you know, and the person being involved in decisions about their treatment. Those principles, I think, are really percolating much more through treatment in many settings. Mm-hmm.
So walk us through the components that are crucial to help people with schizophrenia recover.
The one thing that I think people need is they need almost everyone who we spoke to who did well found supports within their lives, oftentimes family members, frequently friends, people who they could confide in about their experiences and be able to sort of stay in touch with reality. The other thing is that psychosocial treatments for schizophrenia really do work. I mean, you know, the evidence base is very strong for treatments like cognitive behavior therapy for psychosis, which can help people deal with active psychotic symptoms, or supported employment and education, which can provide support for people with schizophrenia while they're actively engaged in work or in school. These programs are extremely effective. On the other hand, they're frequently not available. So whereas almost everyone with the illness has access to medications, which, you know, for many patients are an essential ingredient in order for them to reach their goals, many are just unable to access these other kinds of psychosocial treatments.
Schizophrenia is usually diagnosed in the early 20s after this first psychotic break. That has to be just tremendously scary for the parents. Any advice on first steps for them to take to put them, you know, to put their loved one, to put their child on the path toward recovery?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is that it appears that the sooner someone gets treatment, the better they do. There are studies which suggest that the longer the duration between the time that the person has a first psychotic experiences and the time that they're treated, the length of that time is associated with a worse outcome. So, having people aware of the illness and getting to effective treatment early on is probably one of the most important principles. The other thing is people should stay on the path of their lives. I think too often the stigma of the illness, the sort of images that I talked about earlier about people who do horribly, led people to be fearful of a bad outcome. I think understanding that the person should continue on their current path, people should getting the person back to school or back on the job as quickly as possible is important. One of the sad things in the field is that the stigma often comes from providers. That is, people who should be treating the patient have this belief that once you develop schizophrenia, it's unlikely that you will return to work or school and that you need to be protected. And in fact, many of the people who we spoke to who did well did it despite the providers who try to be overly protective, which is interesting.
So if you start out early, like you said, you know, like many physical or mental illnesses, you tend to have a better outcome. But when we're talking about recovery, you know, can people who maybe didn't get quite that terrific help early on still recover?
Oh, I think so. I mean, okay. if just talking about Dr. Sachs and her book, she obviously did very well despite not getting these specific treatments. It's interesting that she actually got intensive psychoanalysis when she was had a breakdown when she was in England. But I think for other people, the support and encouragement of family and friends is just an essential ingredient, and the role of the family is really underestimated.
Mm-hmm. And underutilized? I guess it would just depend on the family, but they would need to be as supported as well as the patient.
Right. And in fact, educating families about schizophrenia and its treatments is one of the most effective methods for improving outcomes. It's been shown in countless studies that educating families leads to, you know, better long-term outcomes. Staying on medications can be very important. People at the onset of schizophrenia are the group that probably have the greatest vulnerability to suicide attempts and successful suicide. So, making sure that they stay on medications and in treatment and are constantly monitored is very important. And to stay on the path, you know, if that person's path is to school or, you know, some kind of professional school or some kind of vocational or other kinds of goals, to sort of encourage them to stay on that path.
Dr. Stephen Martyr, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Stephen Martyr is a psychiatrist at the UCLA Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior. And finally this week, while there might not be such a thing as being a little bit pregnant, there is growing evidence that you can be almost addicted, as we learned from Harvard psychiatrist Wes Boyd when his book of the same title was published in October 2012.
Being almost addicted means that you're not exactly using drugs in a way that would be considered normal or entirely unproblematic, but at the same time, you're not using drugs in a manner such that your use rises to the level of what we call substance abuse or substance dependence. So it's a gray zone between what we consider diagnostic for substance abuse and what many people would consider normal drug use.
So is this considered kind of on your way, kind of a pre-alcoholic or pre-drug abuser?
Well, it certainly can be. And in fact, that's who we've written the book for, people whose use of drugs falls outside of the normal range. And we've written the book for a couple of reasons. One, we think that it could be causing problems in the moment, even if people don't necessarily see that. And we certainly ask a lot of questions to get people thinking about their drug use. But also because it's certainly using drugs in the almost addicted range certainly could ultimately develop into a full-blown addiction.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example? Because, you know, we've all seen the quizzes that, you know, you may be an alcoholic if, you know, or drug addict if. But what would be someone who's almost addicted? What would be their kind of symptoms, if you will?
Well, they might have some of the same symptoms that someone might have if they were substance abusers or substance dependents, but just to a lesser degree or fewer in number. So one of the things we do in the book is highlight the drug abuse screening test, also called the DAST, D-A-S-T. And that's a commonly used screening tool that asks 20 questions. And if you answer more than 6 of them in the affirmative, it can mean that you're either substance abusing or substance dependent. And most people would just say addicted. But we think that even if you answer a few of the questions, say, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you might be in that almost addicted range. And I can give you some examples of the questions on the drug abuse screening test. They include questions like, have you used drugs other than those required for medical reasons? Do you abuse more than one drug at a time? Can you get through the week without using drugs? Have you engaged in illegal activities in order to obtain drugs? Have you lost a job because of drug use? And so on and so on.
So what are the interventions then? What are you asking these people to do?
Well, that's a great question. First, the first intervention really is to try to be as straightforward and honest with oneself as possible about one's relationship to the substance of abuse. And that can involve asking some pretty hard questions. Also, and this is, you know, quite difficult for a lot of people, but if it's possible, solicit the opinions of your loved ones. Hey, you know, as I'm thinking about it, maybe my marijuana use is a little more problematic than I thought. You know, I've always thought that no one ever noticed, or I did just fine when I was under the influence, but I'm starting to wonder if perhaps there are some greater problems that I'm willing to acknowledge because of it. So, you know, we encourage people to open a dialogue with loved ones. And if there are other people around the person who's using drugs, to never, ever, as we say, enable the behavior, which means sort of cover it up and allow it to exist even though it might be causing problems. And then in terms of interventions, it can require individuals to either use less of the drug than they might be using, or in some cases simply to give it up entirely. Among the other things that we encourage people to do, because bad habits often come in clusters, if there are other parts of your life or other bad habits you have, smoking tobacco, drinking too much, not exercising, et cetera, you know, to try to address those issues as well. Because good habits tend to come in clusters, we actually did some research in writing the book and found, for example, that eating a healthier diet actually is correlated with less substance use, and we cite some data along those lines. And another thing that we encourage people to do is to engage in healthy behaviors, and sometimes that means getting more involved at work, for example, or picking up hobbies or other endeavors that really fulfill you and give you a sense of meaning and purpose, so that you really don't need to fill that void with the substance.
And we were delighted to learn recently that Dr. Boyd's book, whose co-author is Sound Medicine segment producer Eric Metcalf, won the Will Solomine Award for Excellence in Medical Communication from the New England chapter of the American Medical Writers Association. Congratulations to them both.
You were so good to be true. I become addicted to you. You were so sweet to be true.
And that's it for this week's program. We're always interested in what you'd like to hear about on Sound Medicine. You can post comments about today's program on Facebook or submit questions that we might answer on future shows. And we are always on at soundmedicine.org. While you're there, you can subscribe to our free podcast, which is also available at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Swell AM. Sound Medicine senior producer is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program, and he chooses our music. Jen Burnham manages our website and all things social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. And the executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.